do have this little bit of paper that I was going to talk on, but I don't think it's going to do me any good. So I'm just going to speak about what I've seen. I do feel really privileged to be here today, and I know that when I was working in Manus Island, Nauru, I really wasn't aware of this really big contingency of people who actually really proactively care for asylum seekers and refugee rights. And I wish, in hindsight, had I have known, maybe I could have been in contact with Ian Rintel before. But yeah, I'm glad I'm here now. So yeah, thank you. So it's quite difficult to talk about, but when I first arrived in Manus Island, I did say in the inquiry that I'd been working in Nauru for the Salvation Army for 1 year. I was sent to Manus Island in September, and I was present on Nauru for the alleged riots. The reason they sent me to Manus Island was because they felt that staff who were present on Nauru during the riot were too traumatized to return to Nauru, and they wanted to change over the staff. So they sent me to Manus Island. So I thought, you know, having worked on Nauru for 1 year, that I would be prepared. And when I was on Nauru, I spoke in the inquiry that I didn't have any training, but after being there for so long, I was like, I really thought that when I got to Manus Island, I'd be fine. I'd heard horror stories about it, and I knew that staff had come and gone and quit. But when I got to Manus Island, I asked my manager for the next flight home. And I remember sitting in his office asking him, like, please send me home. I don't want to be here. And the first week or so, I was so confronted by what I saw. It was so completely different to Nauru that it's really hard to describe to you. But the men were confined in small spaces behind large fences and padlocked inside, which is something that was different to Nauru. I felt the treatment of asylum seekers by all staff was quite different to Nauru, and I felt that they weren't adequately cared for, they weren't supported, they didn't have clean clothes, they didn't have soap to wash their hands after using the bathroom, they didn't have soap to wash before eating, they couldn't access all the time soap to clean their clothes. I mean, it was, I can't explain to you. I mean, I just sat there day in and day out trying to convince people that one day they'll be out of there, to where, I don't know. And that was something that's really difficult to talk about and to convey to you, that feeling, that sitting there telling a grown man that everything's going to be okay, when in my mind I personally didn't think that it was okay. So that that was really confronting. When I heard that they had been attacked in February, I knew that something like that would happen, and that's something that really plays on my mind now. When I was there, I spoke in the inquiry that an attempted invasion occurred into Delta, and I was in Oscar Compound at the time. So Papua New Guinean men tried to climb over the fence in Delta with machetes as a form of protest. It was quite evident that the locals were not happy that the asylum seekers were there, and in turn the asylum seekers weren't aware of the locals, so there was no cross-cultural communication between the two groups, and they really didn't understand each other. And I think that's something that's really important to speak about, that both groups didn't know each other. So it caused a lot of tension. It was quite evident. Asylum seekers thought, especially after this attempted invasion and another gunfight that actually happened can't remember the exact date now, but there was a gunfight between the two police and, I don't know how to describe, police and mobile police force outside the centre. They were obviously, the asylum seekers obviously knew that it wasn't safe there, and they were often told that the locals were cannibals and they were going to come inside and they were going to kill them and et cetera, so there was a lot of fear, there was a lot of, you know, asking staff, do we need to make weapons, what do we need to do, like, if you're just going to leave when the going gets tough, what are we going to do, like, how are we going to protect ourselves? And in turn, the locals were confused about who was on Manus Island, who was inside the wire. They didn't know who they were. To them, I suppose they could have been perceived as a threat as well. So I think that is something that really built up over time and led to what we saw in February. On the night of the main attack, I got a call from one of the transferees at about 11:30, telling me that shots had been fired and they thought they were gonna die. And they called me and asked me to get the word out. I didn't know how to get the word out because I hadn't spoken to any media or anything like that. So I actually called Ian Rintoul and told him. I just didn't know, like, that feeling of being so helpless. Some people ask me now, are you glad that you don't work there anymore? And the answer is no. I wish that I was there, and I know that that might be hard to understand, but, you know, when you do work there, you feel that you can do something to help, and being outside now and, you know, hearing all the stories and the death of Reza Barati and not being able to do anything besides call media and say, hey, this is what's going on, has been really difficult. So the whole experience, I guess, has been really hard. But I'm really grateful for it, really grateful. And I've learned so much, but yeah, I suppose that if I hadn't have gone, I wouldn't have known. I don't know what to say. I'm just really grateful that I got to go and I got to meet these guys, and now I'm able to speak out about what happened, which is still really scary. But I'm much better at answering questions than speaking to you, so I'm really happy to take any questions, and then I can actually tell you clearer how it was. So yeah.